This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, rape, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Fruit Loops, episode 83. Thank you so much for listening. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we do not hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight cisgender white dudes. No, they are not. There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because the news is racist,
allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists, just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294 and we may feature it on a future episode.
Hey, we got a new voicemail, by the way.
I saw that too. So we'll probably add that to this one. Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. Join the discussion by using the hashtag Fruit Loops Pod Discussion or by joining our Facebook group. All of the footnotes for each episode can be found on our website.
That's right. And if you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. We also have some merch for sale on our website, but if you can't help monetarily, no problem. You can always give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you get your podcasts from, and be sure to share our show with your friends. So yeah, who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today we're talking about Christina Shea Walters, a Native American woman who was a leader of a gang and attempted to murder one woman and then ordered the executions of two other women. The victims were chosen at random. And I guess this is more like spree killing, but eh.
It's true crime nonetheless, yeah, y'all. Yes. That's what you're here for, am I right? So before we get into it, how you doing?
I'm okay. It's getting kind of scary here in Arizona with the coronavirus. Levels are spiking like crazy, and the hospitals are filling up. So it's a little scary out there, and I'm not going anywhere.
You're not going in the office at all?
Oh, no, I have to go into the office twice a week, but yeah. I'm not happy about it.
I am going into the office, and from my vantage point, it is something I look forward to every week. I think I've talked about this before, but this pandemic and what's going on with the racial unrest is going to have ramifications for generations to come, including the kids who are coming up today. They're going back and forth between anxious and excited to play. And it's just a roller coaster of emotions. And we just have to sort of roll with it and, let them feel their feelings. But it's not only like anxiety inducing to adults, which for me, it is extra. I've been meditating my butt off to try to keep it together. And I'm trying to teach my kids how to do the same, but they're going through it just like we are. So
yeah, You know, we had a family Zoom meeting today, and my sister Minnie was on it, and she was telling a story about how she was listening to some kids playing outside her window, and they were saying, "Get it, it's the virus, get it," something like that.
Oh,
they
wow.
were playing virus, and it was dandelions. They were the seeds were blowing in the air, and they were pretending it was the virus.
Wow. Oh, yeah. My gosh. That just made my heart drop.
Yeah.
Holy moly. Yeah. So gosh.
Keep the kids in mind.
Keep the kids, add the kids to the top of all of your prayer lists,
because
they're going to need it for generations to come. Also, speaking of keeping my kids busy and out of my hair, we bought one of those pools on the internet because they were sold out in Arizona. So it's one of those 10-foot wide, 3-foot high pools.
Okay.
And there was a lot of price gouging going on the internet. I don't condone giving Jeff Bezos more money, but Amazon was the only place I could get it. And normally they're like $150. This one was $250.
Oh my God.
But it was worth it because, whoo, hours go by and they are just out there screaming.
They're having a blast.
Oh my God, awesome. It is amazing. Now we're going to get into some listener letters.
Well, hello, angels. Hello, thank you.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So what's in the bag, Beth?
Well, we got an email from Lyra D, who said, "Hello, I've just discovered your podcast and am loving it. Thank you for the quality content. Anyway, I thought you might be interested in a case from my childhood. I'm always banging the drum about this one because it's chilling and thrilling."
Ooh, bang that drum. Bang it.
"I'm a white woman who was born and grew up in the Kingdom of Eswatini, South Africa." And I apologize if I pronounced it wrong. "When I was young, the whole country was in fear of a serial killer who was on the loose for ages. He was believed to be a Moody murderer, harvesting bodies for use in traditional medicine. He was eventually caught, and his name is David Thabo Simelane. There are a few good articles out there about him if you're interested in reading more. Love to you both." And hip hop air horns to you.
That's correct.
Lyra D.
Well deserved.
Yeah. And thank you. And we definitely put him on the list because he sounds interesting.
Very much so. I Googled the name right away. Lots of articles populated. So I don't think we'll have a hard time finding information on Mr. Simelane. We got on IG from Ona35 said, "Y'all got me through this week, and I can't thank you enough. I got too tired of telling grown-ass people what they should already know." This is a black woman, by the way. "I'm tired, and binge listening to you saved my sanity." And again, we say, no, girl, you saved us, because doing the show is like therapy for me. I think Beth too, even.
Yeah.
Though it's a lot of work. I love doing the research. I love coming together once a week and talking about this shit. It brings us great joy.
It does.
So hip hop air horns to you, boo.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes. And we got so many patrons this week. I don't know what is going on. But
yeah, we got a bunch of new members in the Facebook group too.
Yeah. It's great. I think part of it has to do, there was a hashtag going around about like supporting black businesses, including black creators and black podcasters. And so I think that might be where it's coming from.
Could be.
Very grateful. My black ass certainly is grateful.
Definitely.
So thank you. So to our new patrons, I didn't have time to come up with cool jingles for you. So you'll just get hip hop air horns. Casey H. Kim. Chill 024. Kim D. Coming to the stage. Anna L. KQTRR8. And Chelsea A. Baby. Thank you all so much for supporting our little show that I literally am recording from my laundry room. with cardboard boxes and pillows all and around pillows, to try to help with the sound.
So I wanted to say that from what Ona 35 said about being too tired of telling grown-ass people what they should already know, I just wanted to add that as a white ally, and I think probably all of the white listeners of our podcast would consider themselves allies.
Yeah, and I would actually consider you guys accomplices, not just
allies. Oh, sweet. I like that.
Yeah, go even further to do the work.
And please let us know what we can do to help. You know, shout it out, post in the Facebook group.
Yeah.
I'll admit that before Wendy and I became friends, I had no idea how exhausting it is for Black people to have to explain things all the time to white people, especially when they're not receptive.
And ooh, girl. So, thank you for saying it.
Whew. Yes.
I can sit down now.
I've been trying to do my part on Facebook on my own timeline. So
I have been so proud of you. You,
aw, thanks.
You are the only person on my timeline. I'm unfriending a lot of stupid people.
Yeah,
you are the only person who's posting resources, books, things that are outrageous. Black Lives Matter. Like, you are really like doing the work and posting good content to help educate the masses. And
I try.
None of my other white friends are doing it. And I feel like they should be ashamed of themselves for not even trying, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't make any excuses for them. All I can say is that maybe they don't know what to say.
Sure.
So I'm going to try to do more to encourage my white friends to say more and to be more supportive.
Hey, that's why you're on that short list I got. Okay, so this is our little race discussion, and we don't do it every episode. But before we get into this episode, we would like to say that this is a podcast about true crime and people of color. And true crime is difficult to hear about, and sometimes race and even LGBTQ issues can be too. But all of those things are just part of the world that we live in, and we want this to be a safe space where we can have discussions about it. And we may not always say the right things, but we are all learning all the time and hopefully trying to be our best sexy selves. So here we go.
Yeah, and I also wanted to mention that last week, we learned something new. Like Wendy said, we don't always say the right things, but we try. And last week, we found out that Indigenous people of Australia, they do not speak a person's name after they die. Mm-hmm. And here, we're speaking these victims' names throughout the whole podcast, and we had no idea.
Yeah.
And so we did change the intro so that they were at least forewarned that we were going to be speaking their names. And and that's because of our Fruity Jennifer in our Facebook group.
Yes, thank you, Boo.
Yeah, thank you. She let us know that was a thing. So, we are also learning all the time.
Yeah. And like one thing that I want to point out is like, I'm a Black Latinx bisexual woman, but like even LGBTQ issues, I may not like, I was talking to a trans friend the other day and I was like, oh, okay, I see you, mister. And I was like, oh shit, their pronouns are they, them. And I had to like apologize and stuff, but like, I may not always get it right. And even so, you know, we have blinders when we're not a part of another group. And so we're just all doing our best. And for you know, maybe white people or people who are not, you know, Black or, you know, not in a marginalized group who are listening to this and like, I don't even know where to start. Just first Google it. And then if you're comfortable enough, knowing that you may make a mistake, ask a question with a safe person and start a conversation. That's my recommendation.
And we welcome our listeners to be a part of the conversation on Facebook or Twitter at Fruit Loops Pod, or email us at fruitloopspod@gmail.com.
Yeah. And if you're too afraid to like post it in the group, you can always DM us.
We're some questions.
Mm-hmm. And we're not, I'm not the voice of all Black people or all Latinx people or all queer people, but, and Beth certainly isn't the voice of all white people, right? Or all women. but we will definitely give you some feedback based on, you know, our experience and the work that we've done in doing the show. So, whew, that was a mouthful. Now we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to get into the story when we come back.
Hi, True Crime Recruits. I am Margot, host of Military Murder, a show where I have combined my love for the military and my love for true crime to bring you military true crime cases. It's like true crime, but instead of crimes committed by Joe Schmo, the cases I cover are committed by Private Joe Schmo or Veteran Joe Schmo. But don't worry, you don't have to know anything about the military to listen. You just have to be a true crime enthusiast. On the show, I've covered the gruesome 1993 love triangle that led to a soldier's decapitation, the infamous 2007 case of an astronaut who drove cross-country, allegedly in a diaper, to confront her romantic rival, and most recently, I covered serial killer BTK, who is an Air Force veteran. I hope that you'll join me and my true crime army every Monday as I navigate these military true crimes. You can find Military Murder everywhere you listen to podcasts, including Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. Now go on, go subscribe and listen right now.
And we're back. So who's our subject again today, Beth?
Today we're talking about Christina Shea Walters, a Native American woman who attempted to murder one woman and ordered the executions of two other women.
That's right. So now we're going to get into some stats. Wendy's favorite part of all of these stories, because I'm a sick fuck. So Christina Shea Walter, a.k.a. Queen. By the way, I thought it was interesting. White girls always want to be like princesses because that's how they saw themselves, right, like on TV and stuff. And then BIPOC women, Black Indigenous People of Color women, always want to be like queens because those are the only images we saw. There was never any brown princess when I was growing up. Anyway. So Christina Shea Walter, a.k.a. Queen, is an American Indigenous woman who was a leader of a local Crips gang in Fayetteville, North Carolina. She is specifically a Lumbee Indian. We'll talk about more about that later. She ordered the executions of two white women and shot one woman herself who survived. Her victims were, let's speak their names, Tracy Rose Lambert, 18, and Susan Moore, 21, and Deborah Cheeseborough, who was 40, who survived the shooting attack. She had several accomplices, Francisco Paco Tirado, 18, Eric Queen, 19, John Huarbi, 21, Ione, a.k.a. Star Black, not sure of her age, but possibly around 20, Tamika Douglas, who was 15, Carlos Frink, 20, Carlos Neville's, age unknown, and Daryl Tucker, who was 18. Her crimes took place all on August 17, 1998. She was sentenced to death on July 6, 2000, but was taken off of death row on 12-12-12. Remember when we thought that was the year it was that the world was going to end? 2012? Because of the Mayan calendar. And sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And then some other stuff happened. We'll get into it. So now we're going to dive into the setting. Take us there, Beth.
The setting is Fayetteville, North Carolina, the sixth largest city in North Carolina. It is best known as the home of Fort Bragg, a military base located northwest of the city. The fort is named for a Confederate general, Braxton Bragg.
Of course it is.
And in the news lately, there's been a discussion about renaming military bases that are named after Confederate generals, of which there are 10. And of course, Trump is against this.
Yeah, I've been listening to debate around these monuments. And at first, maybe cut to, you know, Wendy 5 years ago, I was like, yeah, cut them all down. Like, you would never have a Hitler statue above like a Hebrew school, you know, or next door. Like, that is just so beyond
just not going to happen. Yeah.
But for some reason, and by the way, all these Confederate statues and naming of places after Confederate generals and stuff only happened with every gain that the civil rights movement gained. In an effort to remind Black people, like, yeah, you got this, but guess what? We got that. And so I think I know that there's a lot of debate around this, but one argument that I heard recently was, what if we recontextualize these things so that they are more truthful. So we don't necessarily have to change the names or take the statues down. But what if we just added more context so that these monuments were more truthful and showed maybe being a Confederate general wasn't a good thing because basically they were traitors and evil human beings. So anyway, it's just an argument that I heard that I wanted to inject. Anyway, North Carolina has the largest Native American population east of the Mississippi River and the eighth largest Native American population in the United States. The area of present-day Fayetteville was inhabited by Eastern Woodland tribes. Indigenous peoples inhabited the area for more than 12,000 years before the European invasion. Guess what happened next?
Yeah. Popular media like books, movies, and TV shows usually focus on Plains tribes and overlook the history and culture of the Eastern Woodland tribes. These tribes lived in forests, and their food, shelter, clothing, weapons, and tools came from the forests around them. They lived in villages near lakes or streams, and their homes were longhouses or wigwams, referred to in the West as wikiups, rather than teepees.
In North Carolina and nearby states, most Native Americans are members of state-recognized tribes and do not live on reservations. Many Native tribes are not recognized by the federal government. They may be recognized by the state they reside in, but not the federal government. The Lumbee tribe is one of these.
An 1875 amendment to the North Carolina State Constitution brought about segregated schools. Native Americans were considered quote-unquote colored and could not attend white schools. The Native Americans of Robeson County insisted that they did not fit into either category. In 1885, the Lumbee tribe, which at the time were called Croatons, established Native-only public schools, and these were not assimilation schools, but rather schools established and run by the tribe.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
In 1913, the North Carolina General Assembly officially labeled the Croatons, or Robeson County Native Americans, the Cherokee Indians of Robeson County. So they just renamed them and making an inaccurate connection to the Eastern Band of Cherokees who lived in the Great Smoky Mountains of Western North Carolina.
In the early 1950s, Reverend D.F. Lowry organized the Lumbee Brotherhood, adopting the name from a local river. In 1952, Robeson County Native Americans overwhelmingly voted to adopt the new name, and the General Assembly subsequently changed their official designation in 1953 to the Lumbees.
It sucks that they had to fight for it, though, don't you know? In 1956, Congress passed the Lumbee Act, which recognized the tribe as Indian. However, the act withheld the full benefits of federal recognition from the tribe. Efforts are still underway to pass federal legislation that grants full recognition to the Lumbee tribe of North Carolina.
When schools were desegregated in the 60s, most of the Lumbee were not happy about it. Native Americans in North Carolina have long experienced discrimination and racism, but in their own schools, the Native American children were shielded from it. Their schools were also used to help the Lumbee retain their cultural identity. And of note, the assimilation schools were not dismantled until the 70s in the U.S. But as I said before, these were not assimilation schools. But we did talk about assimilation schools in our last episode.
Yeah. Not all of the Lumbee were opposed to desegregation, though. Some believed that sending their children to a quote-unquote white school would create opportunities that may not even have been available at the Indian schools.
The reemergence of the Ku Klux Klan during the 50s and 60s was mainly in opposition to the civil rights movement during this time and the integration policies that were being enacted. Lumbees also had dealings with the Ku Klux Klan, and the most famous was the incident at Hayes Pond in Maxton, North Carolina.
All right, buckle up. In January 1958, Grand Dragon James Cole, that just sounds menacing.
Stupid.
Grand Dragon James Cole and 50 other members of the Ku Klux Klan gathered there for a rally in a cornfield. Cole organized the rally to protest the mongrelization of whites and Lumbee Indians. I don't know if mongrelization needs to be defined, but it's not good.
Yeah, that's not a nice word.
No.
But before the rally even began, several hundred Lumbees chased the Klansmen from the cornfield.
Woo!
And despite numerous gunshots, there was only one minor injury. And afterwards, the Lumbees went to the nearby town of Pembroke to celebrate, taking the KK banner with them.
That is awesome. Who's it got is. The victory?
And there's a picture of two Native American men with the KK banner wrapped around them, and they're making funny faces. It's great.
That's awesome. Oh, I love that. Well, I mean, if you think about it, it is just so ridiculous. Mm-hmm. This idea that there's one pure race and that they deserve to somehow stomp out all of the other races for no reason other than they're pale and they get sunburned easily and they can't handle spicy foods.
They want to be on top, I guess.
I guess.
Some people need to go back to Sunday school.
Yes, they do. Oh, but that's another interesting thing is like white Jesus to white people versus Jesus to people of color. And like to people of color, their Jesus is one who accepts everybody, who fights for the poor, who, you know, fights for the little guy. But
yeah, that's my Jesus.
Yeah, I think that's most people's Jesus. But these crazy evangelicals or even the KKK have this idea that Jesus is about more like power and the focus is less on community or accepting other people as Jesus would have and just insulating and uplifting yourself. Anyway, the Maxton riot generated massive local and national media attention, but despite an overall positive tone, the news coverage of the clash illustrated the media's ignorance of Indian history and culture in the South. What does Wendy always say? The news is racist. Reporters used racist stereotypes and simplistic Native American caricatures when commenting on the story, as they tend to do. They also used Plains Indian imagery and iconography to describe the event.
The Lumbee are one of eight state-recognized Native American tribes in North Carolina, and they have about 55,000 enrolled members. According to the 2000 United States Census report, 89% of the population of the town of Pembroke, North Carolina, identify as Lumbee, and 40% of Robeson County's population identify as Lumbee.
Very cool. Every time you say North Carolina, I can't help but summon in my mind the famous rapper Petey Pablo and the rap song that came out in the early 2000s. North Carolina, come on and raise up. Take your shirt off. Swish it around your head. Feel like a helicopter. North Carolina. Do you remember that song?
No, I don't.
Come on. Oh, man. That really gets the club going. I digress.
That's a funny song.
Oh, you got to listen to it. Man, it'll really get you pumped up. Get you ready for that workout.
Words are kind of funny.
North Carolina. Okay. So Lumbee communities are linked together by their extensive kinship ties, church affiliations, their sense of themselves as Indians, and their control of their educational system. Remember, we were talking about their schools. All of which serve as a mechanism for defining tribal membership and maintaining tribal boundaries. Communities are basically self-governing.
Recently in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Gina Hawkins became the first Black female police chief. She is part of the Presidential Commission on Law Enforcement in the U.S., and she herself marched and had her officers march with the protesters in recent Black Lives Matter protests.
By the way, some of these police departments are really getting this crucial moment in time very wrong.
Very wrong.
In Atlanta, there was a Black guy who was shot. Yeah, he was asleep in the drive-thru and then ran away from the police for obvious reasons. I don't know, because they kill us. And they shot him in the back. And then the police chief in Atlanta stepped down. But Atlanta has a Black female mayor who's always like, you know, with the people. So I am not sure what her explanation is on this so far, but
yeah, he was at a Wendy's and there was a crowd that gathered outside and they burned the Wendy's down. It was crazy. There was a video of a guy going into the store and he lit off some fireworks inside the Wendy's and burned it to the ground.
Oh, they did it in response. They didn't do it while he was asleep
in the
drive-thru.
No. In response. Yeah.
Okay.
Still. Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, there's a lot of shit going down and people are angry.
Yeah.
So we did an episode a few episodes back about Christopher Dorner. Remember the LAPD officer who was pissed about the racism in the LAPD and was like, you know what? I tried to go through the proper channels, but fuck it. You guys, now I've had it and I am going to kill every LAPD officer I can.
Right.
And so when they came to apprehend him, they sent like 400 police officers to track him down when he was in the woods in Big Bear. And Dave Chappelle brought this up in his latest comedy special, that police shouldn't be surprised when one cop is killed, hundreds of cops come to apprehend that suspect. So when thousands, even millions of protesters are coming to seek an answer for the death of George Floyd and everybody else who's been killed at the hands of the police, they shouldn't be surprised.
Right.
They're doing the same thing.
They have the same reaction.
Yeah. So now we're going to get into Christina Shea Walters' early life. So unfortunately, we did not know much about Christina Walters' early life. What we do know is that she was born on July 15th, 1978, and that she's a Cancer, and she is Lumbee and possibly also of Cherokee descent, although that may be confusion regarding the tribal name changes that was as a result of U.S. fuckery. She says that she was emotionally, physically, and sexually abused as a child. She has also said that once when a boyfriend attempted to take her shirt off, she cut him with a box cutter.
Christina fell into gang life when she met other youths who had similar upbringings, and she was looking for a family and acceptance and a means to survive. The gang members were Crips, but of varying subgroups called Sets. And Christina's nickname was Queen.
As an adult, when Christina moved in into her own trailer, it became a meeting place for the gang, and she became its de facto leader. She was a woman, and many of the gang members were male. This is pretty unusual. She then found herself in a position of having to regularly assert her dominance as a leader over the gang members who tried to challenge her.
A teardrop tattoo in gang culture can mean many things, depending on its shape and location. In West Coast gangs, of which the Crips are one of, a closed or colored-in teardrop under the eye is supposedly an indicator that the person has killed someone, although gangs can and do attach their own meanings to the tattoo. In any case, Christina reportedly wanted to kill someone to earn this tattoo in order to secure her position.
By the way, I've always been envious of people who have face tattoos. Like, you either have no choice, like, you have to either be a rapper or some sort of tattoo model, or have to have, like, a lot of money in the bank. Otherwise, like, how are you going to get a job? And so I've always thought, like, when I'm wealthy enough someday or retired and have nothing else to lose, that I will get those face tattoos and a full sleeve, just as like an F you to the patriarchy, everybody, just to say I don't need you anymore. I don't have to live by your rules.
When I see people with face tattoos, I think they're just like thinking, I don't give a fuck about anything, you know?
Yeah. Which is admirable. I mean, if you ask me, I mean, the only thing keeping me from having my face tattooed is the fact that I have an employer.
Yeah. No, I don't think I would get my face tattooed. That's not something that interests me.
You don't want Fruit Loops on your forehead?
No. I'll have it tattooed somewhere else.
We can get matching ones, like on our matching tramp stamps.
In the 90s, I wanted a tramp stamp so bad, but I didn't know it was a tramp stamp. I just wanted a lower back tattoo, you know?
Oh, interesting.
And then I heard people calling it tramp stamps, and I was like, oh, I guess I don't want one.
Oh. Yeah, I got my tramp stamp like on my 18th birthday.
Oh, wow. Oh, and, yeah, that's right. You told me, I didn't know it was a tramp stamp, but
yeah,
you told me you got a tattoo on your 18th birthday.
Yeah, mostly just to piss off my dad, but I'd always wanted one. And I think that you would be hard pressed to find a girl from age 30 to 40 who doesn't have a tramp stamp. If you're out there, come find me. So now we're going to get into the timeline. So on Sunday, August 16th, 1998, Christina Walters, who was 20, and eight of her gang members gathered at her trailer in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and made plans to steal a car. The gang members included Paco Tirado, who was 18, Eric Queen, 19, John Huarbe, 21, Ion Star Black, who was maybe 20, Tamika Douglas, who was 15, Carlos Frink, 21, Carlos Nevilles, and Daryl Tucker, who was 18.
The plan was to steal a car, drive it into the window of a pawn shop, and then steal some stuff from the pawn shop.
Mm.
Sounds like a crazy plan.
Very much so.
Before they did this, several gang members, including Walters, went to a local Walmart to buy bullets. And while they were there, they also stole some toiletry items and some clothing. They then went back to Walter's trailer, where Tirado painted the tips of the bullets blue with fingernail polish that Walters had. Blue is the color identified with the Crips gang.
Mm. Yes. And Snoop Dogg is identified with the Crips. And,
oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And they do a dance called the Crip Walk. Where they basically spell out different symbols with their feet in a very rhythmic fashion. It's really cool. And then I think it got kind of commercialized with the advent of rap videos, et cetera,
oh,
et cetera.
Yeah.
And then everybody believed they
everybody
could crip walk, including myself. So soon afterwards, Walters and a deaf black male, name unknown, who was not a part of the gang, drove Douglas, Black, and Nevilles to a neighborhood location and dropped them off with instructions to find a victim, to steal the victim's car, to put the victim into the trunk of the car, and then return to Walters' trailer.
Walters gave Nevilles a gun, and then she and the deaf black male drove away, leaving Douglas, Black, and Nevilles there. The three gang members walked around looking for someone to rob. When around 12:30 a.m. on Monday, August 17th, they spotted Deborah Cheeseborough, 40, a black woman, a wife, and a mother of two. She was leaving a Bojangles restaurant where she was the manager.
By the way, that list of go to a neighborhood, drop them off, steal a car, put them in the trunk, get the car, return to Walter's.
Right.
It's like a gang scavenger hunt.
Yeah. The worst scavenger hunt
ever. So Douglas, Black, and Nevilles abducted Deborah at gunpoint and drove around in her car with her in the back seat before stopping to put her in the trunk. And at the same time, robbing her of jewelry and money. They returned to Walter's trailer, where the gang gathered around the car.
It was at this point that the gang became aware of Walter's intention to kill someone while they were discussing what to do with Deborah. Prior to this, the rest of the gang believed that the mission was about robbing and stealing, but Walters brought it to the next level.
I wonder, too, I didn't see anything in the sources or in the story about, like, what they may have been under the influence of.
I didn't see anything about drugs at all or alcohol.
Yeah.
Nothing.
But I find it hard to believe that they would have pursued this gang scavenger hunt completely sober.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I didn't see anything in any of the sources about alcohol or drugs.
Yeah. Samesies. With Deborah still in the trunk, Walters, Douglas, Frank, and Queen got into Deborah's car and drove her to Smith Lake, a location at the Fort Bragg military base. There, Deborah was let out of the trunk and Walters told her to get down on one knee.
Eone Black later recalled, "I remember her saying stuff like, 'Don't hurt me, and I've got two kids.' She said, 'Take my money, you've already got my car.' Walters attempted to fire the gun at Deborah, but it jammed. Walters said, 'Hold up,' and tried to unjam the gun. Walters then raised the gun again, this time at the level of Deborah's waist, and fired the bullet into Deborah's right side."
After the shot knocked Deborah down onto her stomach, Walters shot her 7 more times. The final shot went through Deborah's glasses, grazed her eyelid, and hit her thumb. Deborah pretended to be dead.
After the gang members left, Deborah dragged herself up to the street. She later testified that she heard her deceased mother's voice comforting her and telling her that it wasn't my time yet. Robert McClenahan, a passing motorist, found Cheeseboro at about 2 p.m. on the 17th. So she was laying out there that whole time.
Oh, my God.
He said he saw what he thought was a pile of clothes on the side of the road.
Then he saw Deborah's head lift up and he realized it was a person and he got help. After arriving at the scene, Army medic Jesse Enoll said Cheeseboro was covered in ants. He noticed at least 7 entry wounds. Medics transported Cheeseboro to Womack Army Hospital.
And I guess it was because they were on the Army base. Because when I first read that part about the Army medic, I'm like, Army medic? What? But yeah, which seems really weird that they took her to the Army base to kill her.
That is strange, too. I mean, I thought you needed special, like, clearance to get onto those things.
Yeah, I don't know. It might have been on the outskirts. Okay. I don't know. Maybe they didn't even know they were on the Army base. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, after the gang left Deborah for dead, they returned to Walter's trailer where they decided that they needed a second car for some reason.
Okay.
Tucker, Black, Queen, and Walters rode around in Deborah's car, finally zeroing in on a car driven by Susan Moore, 21, and Tracy Lambert, 18, was a passenger. The two women were dancers at a nightclub and were heading home from work at about 2 a.m.
The gang pulled up next to the car and began yelling and waving guns. Susan tried to get away but made a wrong turn and ended up trapped at the end of a dead-end road. Oh, my God. That's like
nightmare.
Nightmare. That's what they write in movie scripts. Walters handed a gun to Tucker, telling him to go do what you gotta do.
Walters, Frank, and Queen then drove away in Deborah's car after Queen directed Black, Tucker, and Douglas to be at Walters' trailer in 45 minutes. Tucker and Douglas forced Moore and Lambert into the trunk at gunpoint, and then Black, Tucker, and Douglas returned to Walters' trailer with the women in the trunk.
When the gang was all back at Walters' trailer, they surrounded the car and discussed who would kill the women. Then the entire gang, half in Deborah's car and half in Moore's car, drove to a location in Linden where the women were forced out of the trunk.
Walters directed her gang members to kill the women. Eone Black later testified that they were crying and kept asking, "What are you all going to do with us?" But the gang had just witnessed Walters shoot Deborah Cheeseboro and knew that to refuse was suicide.
Tracy Lambert kept saying, "Please don't hurt us." She was walking and had her hands over her head. And I remember her saying, "Oh God, Susan, we're going to die. I don't want to die." Eric Queen told Tracy to shut up and then shot her in the head.
At the same time, Paco Tirado was holding Susan Moore with a knife to her throat. She begged him not to slit her throat and to shoot her instead, which he did.
The gang members once again returned to Walter's trailer. After talking for a while, the group split up with instructions to return by 3:30 p.m. So that's the timeline. Now we're going to get into the investigation and the arrest.
When Eone Black returned home after the murders and attempted murder, she was terrified. She knew that at least a couple of the people in the gang were aware that she had not wanted to be there when the crimes occurred.
Around dawn, Frank called Walters with the news that some bodies had been found. When the gang met up at Walters' trailer, Black was not there. She had never witnessed a murder before and felt, quote-unquote, like they might try to do something to her.
When some of the gang members came looking for her, Black's roommate told them that Black had gone to her mother's house, which was a lie. Seven members of the gang, including Walters, took the stolen cars and fled to Myrtle Beach, using Susan Moore's cell phone to place calls to family and friends. And that does not seem very smart.
Not a wise decision. Nevels and Black did not go with the rest of the gang to Myrtle Beach. Later that evening, Black called 911 and told the operator that she had, quote, seen some people get shot, end quote. And she gave descriptions of the people who were involved.
On Tuesday, August 18th, Huarbe and Tucker were apprehended in Deborah's car by Myrtle Beach police officers. And on Wednesday, August 19th, Walters, Frank, Douglas, Queen, and Toronto were apprehended and arrested at the Bonvia Motel in Myrtle Beach in a room that had been rented by Walters.
So that took no time at all.
Yeah.
Detectives found gang paraphernalia, Deborah Cheeserow's purse, and the license plates from the two stolen cars in Walters' mobile home. The cars with stolen dealer tags were found in Myrtle Beach. The suspects were wearing gang-related blue bandanas, and Eon Black turned herself in to authorities.
Cumberland County Sheriff Earl Butler said that there have been many violent incidents in the county that have consisted of attacks between gang members, but during his career, he had never heard of a gang member singling out people at random in this way.
Thank goodness they were caught quickly. Can you imagine how terrifying this would have been if they were just on the loose?
Yeah.
I mean, it's already terrifying, but you know, the media, very much so. The media covered Susan Moore and Tracy Lambert's murders extensively. Remember, these are two white ladies. They were pretty young, blonde, again, white women. Deborah Cheeserow was a middle-aged Black woman, and her attempted murder did not get much coverage. Wonder why?
Curious. Many people did not even know that a Black woman had been targeted, and they were quick to claim this as a hate crime against white people.
Oh, boy.
The media also reported extensively that this was a crime related to a gang initiation, but it was not.
Boy, the media sure gets it wrong a lot.
Yeah, they do. when you start doing research for these kinds of stories, you read a lot of articles and you have to like compare and look at court records and all kinds of stuff. And we may get the details wrong sometimes, but I do the best I can to try to cross-reference. But a lot of times, yeah, the media gets it wrong.
Yeah, no. And Beth is like so thorough. Like, I'm like, I'll find an article. Sounds about right. Put it in the doc.
I can't help it.
I know.
I'm like OCD about it.
Everybody wants to be first to report.
So they're not so careful about the details.
Yeah, and there's less desire to be correct and accurate.
And it seems like sometimes an article will come out and say something, and then all the other articles will say almost the exact same thing, and it's not necessarily correct. So
yeah. So now we're going to get into the trial. So Francisco Paco Tirado and Eric Queen were tried first. Eon Black, who was also charged in the murders, testified in their trial after making a deal with the state in which she would not face the death penalty and would possibly have her murder charge reduced to second-degree murder in exchange for her testimony. Eon Black told jurors how the victims were picked at random to be kidnapped and killed. Both Tirado and Queen were found guilty and sentenced to death.
Walters was tried next, and Deborah Cheeserow testified at her trial. The jury found her guilty on all charges. When the jury read their verdict, Walters cried uncontrollably. After she was led from the courtroom, her grandmother, Judy Walters, began hyperventilating and screaming. Then she said she was having a heart attack. 911 was called, and she was taken from the courtroom on a stretcher. And I feel really bad for Judy Walters.
Yeah, I mean, this we'll get into it on our takeaways, but this crime not only affected the victims and their families, but the fact that these this gang, they have family members too. So
yeah,
they did
lots
these,
of people affected
yeah,
by this.
Yeah, a lot of people affected by this. So following a capital sentencing proceeding, the jury recommended a sentence of death for each of the murders, and the trial court entered judgments accordingly. The trial court also sentenced Walters to consecutive terms of imprisonment for each of the 9 other felony convictions.
In 2009, North Carolina passed the Racial Justice Act. The Racial Justice Act allowed death row inmates to present evidence that race was a significant factor in the capital sentencing process. The minority population in North Carolina had reached 34%, according to the nonprofit Center for Death Penalty Litigation. But of the 142 prisoners on death row, nearly half were convicted by juries with little or no minority representation.
Well, a 1986 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Batson v. Kentucky, forbid prosecutors from rejecting jurors on the basis of race alone. But researchers at Michigan State University found in a 2012 study of North Carolina death penalty trials that Black jurors are 2.5 times more likely to be struck. I am dying to be on a jury, but guess why I'm not? Because
yeah.
I'm Black. Anyway.
Only 4 people had sentences reduced under the act. Tillman Golphin, Marcus Robinson, Quintel Augustine, and Christina Walters. All of them had been convicted of murder in Cumberland County.
While potential Black jurors were purportedly dismissed for reasons such as reservations about the death penalty, criminal background, hardship, or employment, white jurors with similar characteristics were left on jury panels. 2 of the 3 defendants were Black, and both were tried by overwhelmingly white juries.
In the case of Quintel Augustine, who is Black, every member of the jury that handed down the death penalty to him was white. Court filings argue that Cumberland County prosecutors improperly used race as a primary factor in choosing Augustine's jurors. In one case, a potential juror was described in handwritten notes as a quote-unquote Black wino.
What?
And then rejected. Notes for a white juror who was accepted read, quote, drinks, country boy, okay.
Oh my fucking God. That's a Batson violation.
Yep.
During Walters' trial, prosecutors rejected 10 out of 14 qualified Black jurors and 4 of 27 whites. One Black woman was struck because her brother had been convicted of an unrelated gun charge. The woman told prosecutors that she and her brother were not close and his criminal record would not affect her jury service. At the same time, a non-Black juror was chosen despite having a brother jailed on a murder charge and writing him regular letters.
Well, that doesn't seem right.
Come again?
Evidence was presented to show that the prosecutor who picked the jury in Walter's case had a history and practice of excluding Black people from jury service in capital cases, and that the prosecutor had been trained to strike Black people and evade the guidelines of Batson v. Kentucky, and evidence of a decades-long culture of race discrimination in the office, which prosecuted Walters.
I guess it's things that we all knew were there, but
right.
when it's
laid out for you.
Yeah. I just watched Just Mercy about Brian Stevenson and
I have that on my watch list. Yep.
It's pretty good about the Equal Justice Initiative, and this is his life's work, is getting people off of death row and then getting people's wrong convictions overturned.
Reversed, yeah.
Anyway, evidence uncovered in the RJA cases showed that racial bias in North Carolina's death penalty is systematic, not the work of a few isolated bad actors. It's not just a few bad apples. The whole system is rotten. The whole barrel is rotten. This evidence included derogatory and demeaning questioning of Black jurors, including asking if a juror could read, discriminatory handwritten prosecutor notes about prospective jurors, and a prosecutor who referred to a Black defendant as a big Black bull.
Oh my God.
Lord have mercy.
Whew. Then there was the case of a black defendant whose trial was compromised when his family was barred from sitting near the front of the courtroom by using crime scene tape across the chairs behind the defendant, making it look as if he were a danger to the people behind him.
Oh my God. It really is a shit show.
Yeah.
The judge reviewed an exhaustive study of North Carolina prosecutors' strikes and acceptances of more than 7,400 jurors in 173 North Carolina capital murder trials between 1990 and 2000, and found a wealth of evidence showing the persistent, pervasive, and distorting role of race in jury selection throughout North Carolina. And by the way, people always talk about, oh, it's the justice system. It's the only system we have. But the system was designed this way.
Yeah.
To literally imprison, stifle poor black and brown communities and protect white affluent people and their property. And that's it.
Yeah. The judge wrote that prosecutors struck black jurors at more than twice the rate of all other jurors with remarkable consistency in strike rates in every county and across the entire period of time studied. Race, he said, was a materially, practically, and statistically significant factor in decisions to exercise peremptory challenges during jury selection by prosecutors when seeking to impose death sentences in capital cases. And he concluded that the strikes were intentionally undertaken on the basis of race.
Yeah, but you tell a prosecutor that, and they're like, no, absolutely not. Yeah. And again, we've talked about this before. It's really hard for white people sometimes to see their whiteness, especially mm-hmm. when they're a prosecutor trying to weaponize it. anyway, but the Republican-led legislature repealed the RJA in 2013, and Governor Pat McCrory, a Republican, signed the repeal into law. And in December 2015, the North Carolina Supreme Court vacated the judge's ruling, sending the four defendants back to death row, including Walters.
In March 2018, the state Supreme Court announced that it would hear RJA appeals from the four prisoners, as well as from two other prisoners whose RJA claim had also been filed but not heard. And on June 5th, 2020, so just, you know,
a week ago,
10 days ago, yeah. The North Carolina Supreme Court ruled the repeal was unconstitutional, restoring the full protections of the Racial Justice Act for people who filed claims before the law was repealed in 2013. So this is new.
This
new
is very new news. Extra, extra, read all about it. Justice is slow, but I guess it moves eventually.
Yeah.
The ruling ensures that none of the individuals who had filed claims can be executed without the opportunity to prove the role of racial bias in their cases. Over 100 death row inmates now have the opportunity to prove racism affected their sentences because they had filed a claim under the state's Racial Justice Act, or RJA, before it was repealed in 2013. So now we're going to get into where are they now, at least what we know. So Christina Shea Queen Walters was convicted and sentenced to death. Eric Queen was convicted, sentenced to death, and then committed suicide in prison in 2007. Francisco Paco Tirado, convicted and sentenced to death. John Huarbe, convicted and sentenced to 29 years in prison and projected to get released on January 10th, 2023. Ione Starr Black pled guilty, sentenced to at least 4 years and 10 months in prison. Tamika Douglas.
We didn't touch on this, but Tamika Douglas was 15 when this happened.
Right. So, yeah, they were all really, really young.
Yeah.
But I think she was the youngest.
She was the youngest, yeah.
Pled guilty, and she was sentenced to two consecutive life sentences without parole. But just given her age, I can't believe that.
That doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
And she didn't kill anybody. She was
exactly,
there.
Exactly. Yeah.
She didn't kill anybody. So that that seems like overkill.
But she
overboard.
Was, she was black, right? So.
Right.
But Carlos Frink was convicted and sentenced to two consecutive life sentences without parole. Carlos Nevels was convicted and sentenced to two consecutive life sentences without parole. And Daryl Tucker was convicted and sentenced to 45 years in prison. So there you go.
After her attempted murder, Deborah Cheeseborough was in the Womack Army Hospital for a month. Mm. And then she spent another month in a rehabilitation center. She still has two bullets lodged in her body. And I believe she is still married to her husband, Michael, and that they have been married for some 40 years now, and wow, that they are grandparents.
Well, that's a silver lining.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into what we think made her snap and also our takeaways. So hit it, Beth.
So this is another case where we don't know enough about the perpetrator's early life. But we know that some people are at greater risk of becoming offenders because of the circumstances into which they are born. These people are not bad seeds who commit crimes because it's, as Wendy says, super fun. They were once children, most of them brought up in less than ideal circumstances and have problems related to that. And I'm guessing this is the root of Christina Walters' crimes. She joined a gang for family and acceptance, and once she became a leader, she enjoyed the status and power that came with it. And since she's female, she needed to do something wild to maintain her status, and murder fit the bill.
Mm.
And I just wanted to say, with all this stuff about defunding the police and whatnot, as a nation, we have a history of being fixated on punishment rather than on preventing crime and rehabilitation, mm-hmm, particularly for low-level crimes or for like the 15-year-old Tamika Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
We just threw her away.
Mm-hmm.
And what if we could prevent crimes before they have a chance to happen? What if, instead of throwing money at the police, we use some of that money to support the people and families who are at greater risk?
Mm-hmm.
What if, as a nation, we focus on that instead of waiting around for people to commit crimes, throwing their lives away like garbage, because we're only interested in punishing people?
Yeah.
And the more I read these stories and research these stories, it all comes back to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
These kids were failed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a surprise that they became criminals.
Yeah. And Matt, I guess it costs less money to send a juvenile to college than it does to send them to the incarceral
yeah,
system.
Yeah. Let's have some college instead.
Let's have some college. Yeah. But then that leads to an educated population capable of enacting change in a society. And perhaps for those people at the top, the Mitch McConnells of the world, they don't want to.
They don't like
change.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it sort of protects the status quo to continue to fail youth
keep
like
these people
this.
Down.
Yeah. Yeah. And have them end up in the, you know, prison system, which makes a lot of people a lot of money. And these prisons in these rural communities employ a lot of people. So it's just like this vicious cycle that the people who are being put through this meat grinder can't win. Have you ever seen?
Let's put a stop to this.
Yeah, let's do it. by the way, I think I've said this before. One of my favorite hashtags is traumatic injuries on Instagram.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I keep seeing the same photo popping in my feed of some guy's hand stuck in a meat grinder.
Oh my God,
it's very gross, but I love it.
Oh. Yeah, I don't get it, but I still
love
you.
You don't want me to send it? I've been taking screenshots and sending them to my brothers,
nope,
and they get
don't
so
send it to
mad.
Me.
Okay, I will. So I too wish I knew more about Christina Walters' upbringing, but I agree. People, again, don't just join gangs because it's so fun. I'm basically reiterating everything Beth said. So I don't want to reiterate because I agree with everything you said. These kids were just at a disadvantage and did what they could to survive. They were also kids. They were immature as all hell, incapable of making sound decisions. At the same time, this is, you know, true for other groups who are looking for validation, acceptance, and community. And groups like the Tea Party and alt-right. We don't agree with them, but they're obviously congregating because they want community and validation, right?
Right.
So I think we have to look at the condition that, as Beth said, made these gangs necessary. And we talked about defunding the police, but I have the same questions that Beth does. Imagine if we took money away from the police and gave it to teachers and education and all these other places that are underserved so that our communities are stronger and need less.
We don't need the police as much.
Exactly. And indigenous communities, don't fact check me on this, but I believe might be even more marginalized and underserved than other BIPOC communities.
I think that's probably true. Yeah.
Yeah. And imagine if the U.S. answered for all of its fuckery. I do not condone any of the crimes. I don't think anyone would should take another person's life, including the state. But it's just a sad case because there were so many young people's lives cut short, the victims, their families, including Deborah Chesbrough and her two kids, you know, like everybody left in the wake of this case, their lives are forever changed. So,
yeah. Yeah.
So now we're going to get into how not to get murdered. So if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode and we'll just offer up generic tips.
Yeah. So these are tips that we've given before. So I'm going to just rattle off some real quick ones. And then if I can go back into some old info and put the names of some of these safety apps, I will. But I did want to get into a debate with you about the last tip that I didn't put in the doc. So here we go. Get ready, Beth.
Deborah
Chesbrough got off work late alone, and Susan Moore and Tracy Lambert got off work together, and they buddied up. And you would think that would keep them safe, but they were still victims. So if you work late, which I have done before, text or call the people so they know when you are leaving and know when to expect you home. If you can get escorted to your car, take advantage of that. Download a safety app to your phone, which will send there are apps that can send your location to loved ones or people in your circle. There's also safety apps that will immediately connect you to law enforcement, or apps that will make a loud noise in the event that you are in a place that you are unsafe. Also carry mace, pepper spray, and or a knife. And I started to type this out in the doc and I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't. But I wonder if you are a single woman and you live alone and you work late, if it's worth it to get a gun, like get one safely, do all the classes, get the permits, and carry one on you to keep you safe. I wanted to know your thoughts.
Me?
Yeah.
I would not get a gun just because I don't like them. And I don't feel safe having one. Mm-hmm. I'd always be afraid that the person would get it away from me and use it on me. Mm-hmm. But I am not, you know, against other people doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just a tip that I just sort of was thinking, like, I am afraid of guns personally. And I think there's so many guns out there already in the wrong hands. But if I guess if that is something that would make you feel safer and you are in a position where you are on your own in the evening.
But definitely, if you do get a gun, take classes, learn how to use it, get comfortable with it, take it to a shooting range, spend a lot of time with it so you feel comfortable And really think about it if you think you would be able to shoot somebody, because that's the other thing. The other reason why I don't feel comfortable with a gun is I don't know if I'd be able to shoot somebody. And so I might hesitate and they could overpower me and take the gun from me. So I just don't think it's a good option for me. But if somebody else feels comfortable, like they've grown up with guns, they know all about guns, or they're willing to put in the time to get comfortable with a gun, then it might be a good option.
Yeah. And it's never been a tip that we suggested in the past. I just felt like it needed to be worth it to be mentioned. That's all.
It's something to think about.
Yeah. My dad was a gun owner and he always said, don't have a gun if you're not like in your mind willing to kill somebody.
Yes. Yes.
So now we're going to get into the shout out portion of our show where we shout out any content of people of color, by people of color, or any true crime goodies. So I don't have a true crime goodie, but I just wanted to say I totally swapped out other one.
You did have one.
I did, but I swapped it just because in light of our episode that involved a Native American woman, I wanted to shout out a couple Netflix picks by and about indigenous people. The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open. It's on Netflix and it's about two indigenous women, their relationship to each other, love, motherhood, and status are themes of the movie. And then Murata, How Mom Decolonized the Screen. And it's by a New Zealand filmed archivist. His name is Heppery Mita, and it traces the cinematic legacy of his mother, a trailblazing Maori filmmaker named Murata Mita. And
wow, that sounds really interesting.
It is really, really interesting. And the themes that come up in this one are about family, and she literally is like this woman of color making all these independent films and coming up against all these barriers, and she's like, fuck it, I'm just gonna go forward.
Just gonna do it.
Yeah. And then the racism in New Zealand is just as bad as anywhere else.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't realize that before.
I didn't either.
So anyway, really, really good documentaries about indigenous people.
Cool. So mine is something lighter. My sister Minnie has been trying to get me to watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine for a while now. And they probably don't need my shout out. It's a popular show, but I'm doing it anyway because comedies have been the only thing getting me through. Anyway, at first, before I actually started watching it, I tried to watch the first episode several times, but couldn't get past it because I hated the Andy Samberg character. And Minnie kept telling me, it gets better. Keep watching. And then we had our Fruit Loops patron Zoom meeting, and several other fruities chimed in, including our fruity Rondica. And I finally decided to push through the first season. And yeah, I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
Because you guys were right. I was wrong. The show's hilarious, and it has a lot of great POC characters.
Yeah. And it does a really good job of touching really difficult subjects, including sexism in the workplace, race, and race in police, all kinds of really, really good themes in the show. And it's so
funny.
And
And it's on Hulu. So if anybody else wants to watch it, it's on Hulu.
Great recommendations, Beth. Much appreciated. So where can the people find us?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod. And our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help. And as always, we have merch for sale on our website.
That's right. Now, listen up close. This is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there.
Thank you.